The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about mosquitoes that deliver vaccines. Some sort of genetic engineering going on here, Dave?
Well, there's a little bit of genetic engineering going on here, Rob, but this is actually a different approach that has been taken to combating some of the problems that mosquitoes cause, like malaria and other diseases. And researchers before have tried to manipulate mosquitoes in various ways. They've engineered mosquitoes so that they are resistant to infection and, you know, with the hopes of releasing them into the population, then they would somehow outcompete maybe the other types of mosquitoes. But those efforts haven't really gone much of anywhere. There are other efforts to actually make mosquitoes sterile so that then when they mate with other mosquitoes in the general population, they don't give rise to viable offspring. And the idea is you can reduce the number of mosquitoes and theoretically reduce the number of mosquitoes that would transmit malaria and other diseases. But this new study takes a completely different approach. And the approach is, hey, these mosquitoes are biting people anyways. And when mosquitoes bite people, they inject proteins in their saliva into our bloodstream, which actually is part of the reasons we get itchy with a mosquito bite. And they said, you know, if these mosquitoes are injecting stuff into us anyways, why don't we turn these mosquitoes into flying vaccines? Why don't we genetically engineer them so that when they bite somebody, they're actually conferring protection against malaria or leishmaniasis or any of the other diseases that plague people in areas where there are a lot of mosquitoes?
I can understand with one mosquito biting you, but if you have dozens or hundreds or even thousands of mosquito bites, you're going to get a lot different dose.
That's clearly one of the problems with this approach, and that's what researchers discovered. What they did was they tested this on mice, and they genetically engineered some mosquitoes that they would produce this candidate vaccine against leishmaniasis, which is this disease that causes skin sores and organ damage. And they made it so that when mosquitoes would bite these mice, they would transmit this. And what they found was that it did work like a vaccine, that the mice that were bitten started to produce antibodies, which theoretically would protect them against leishmaniasis. But as you said, Rob, there's a problem of controlling the dosage here. You know, when you and I get a vaccine shot, we get one shot. And some of these mice got bit, you know, maybe 50 times, and some of these mice got bit over 1,000 times. And so they were getting widely different doses of this vaccine. And that's clearly a problem if you want to vaccinate a human population. You don't want some people getting, you know, say 500 measles shots in one arm and another person only getting one measles shot or no measles shots at all. So that's one of the big problems. The other problem is this whole issue of informed consent. I mean, whenever, you know, you do a clinical trial or you vaccinate people, you want to make sure they're actually consenting to being vaccinated. And you can imagine if you're releasing a whole bunch of mosquitoes into a population of humans and some people are getting bitten, some people aren't, and some people may want the vaccine and some people may not. You have huge ethical issues there. So even though it's an interesting proof of concept, even the authors acknowledge this is not the sort of thing we're going to see deployed tomorrow. What they say might be a promising avenue is actually using this with animals like livestock, where you don't obviously have to deal with issues of informed consent. And this might be a much better way of protecting livestock and other animals from diseases and a much more efficient way than we have right now.
Somehow isolating the livestock so that the people don't also get bitten by these vaccine-delivering mosquitoes.
Exactly. You want to control for that.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this next story is slightly less theoretical than the previous story. It's about what may be the most powerful magnetic material ever created.
So researchers have built one? What's it made out of?
Rob, the material is an amalgam of iron and nitrogen. It's actually 8 parts of iron and 1 part nitrogen. And what's so special about this unique combination is that it's 18% more magnetic than what was previously believed to be the most magnetic material, which was a combination of iron and cobalt.
Well, what makes the iron-nitrogen mixture so much more magnetic?
Well, Rob, what makes things magnetic in the first place is their electrons. Each electron in a material acts like a little magnet within itself, and its magnetic field is aligned with its axis of spin. So when you have more electrons spinning in one direction than the other direction, you get magnetism. In a material like iron cobalt, you have a lot of electrons spinning in one direction and not in the other direction, which makes it a very highly magnetic material. Well, normally, an iron atom has four more electrons spinning one way than the other, which gives the iron its magnetism. But when you put it with a bunch of other atoms, the magnetism goes down because all those atoms are interacting with a lot of other atoms. What's happening with the iron nitrogen amalgam is that the structure of the compound is actually allowing some of the electrons in the iron atoms to get stuck or localized, as physicists say, where they are. And as a result, those atoms contribute more like individual atoms to the overall magnetism, which really drives the entire magnetism of the compound way up.
What are other researchers saying about this now that they actually have a sample of this?
Well, having an actual sample is really important. Other groups have tried this before. They've actually speculated that such a compound might be more magnetic, but they've really met with mixed success in both creating and analyzing the sample. This is the first time that researchers have actually been able to reliably grow a sample of this iron nitrogen compound. And so researchers are really excited about that. And they say it could have some potential real world applications. When you think about things that are magnetic that we use in our daily lives, like computer hard drives, if you had something that was even more magnetic with a computer hard drive, you could potentially create smaller write heads, which would allow a lot more information to be crammed into the same amount of space. So this isn't just sort of an interesting physical sciences in advance. This is something that could have applications for technology down the line.
Okay, so last one. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, we've done a biological sciences story and we've done a physical sciences story. This last story sort of merges the two together, and it tackles the question of why we run on bouncy legs.
How are they bouncy? What do you mean?
Well, according to computer simulations, at least, we would be much more efficient runners if we ran on peg legs. In other words, if our legs were completely stiff, like robot legs, not sort of the bouncy, gelatinous legs that we're saddled with. And the reason is because at least computers tell us that inflexible legs are a lot more efficient when it comes to running than the legs that we have. So the question is, why are our legs so compliant? And to figure that out, researchers actually did some more computer modeling, which is where the physical sciences come in. And they actually looked at a number of animals, specifically animals like guinea fowl and even rodents, you know, a variety of animals to see, you know, all these animals that sort of run with, you know, what we might call squishy legs, and compare to the computer model and to try to figure out, okay, why, from an evolutionary perspective, are our legs bouncier than they theoretically should be.
In thinking through the computer simulation, I'm guessing that maybe researchers in the past didn't account for sort of the uneven ground that we run over. Is that it?
That's definitely part of the problem. I mean, first we have this uneven ground, which stiff legs would not do very well with. And that's the first thing the researchers found. You know, we would not be able to handle obstacles without falling. You can actually see a video of a guinea fowl having some problems running on a treadmill on the site. That's the first problem. The other problem is that, you know, these early computer models that said, you know, hey, peg legs are better, didn't really account for the rest of our bodies. These are seesawing guts, you know, and our bouncing bellies and other things like that. And it turns out that with compliant legs, the spring in our step that these compliant legs allow offsets this bounciness in our bodies, resulting in a much more efficient run or even a walk than you would assume based on a very simple computer model.
So our legs are squishy because the rest of us is squishy.
That's definitely part of the reason our legs are squishy, because the rest of us is squishy, and our legs are squishy because it's just a lot easier to run in the real world with all the obstacles that a real world run entails than it would be if you had a pair of stiff peg legs to run on.
You mentioned peg legs. Is this going to help in making better prosthetics, or how is this research going to be applied?
It's a great question, Rob. And you can definitely imagine that, you know, the more we know about how we run and why we run the way we do, you could theoretically imagine that being applied to prostheses and even creating future robots for making them run and walk more efficiently. So a lot of potential applications for this research.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about how zebrafish repair broken hearts and how that might be applied to mending human heart tissue. And also probing the mystery of male olives. Turns out there's not very many male plants out there, but among olives, there are a lot of male plants. And we'll be looking into why that is the case. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking at what the impact is of the large healthcare overhaul bill that President Obama just signed into law, what the impact is on science and research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news and all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.